to the Onyx Pathcast. I am one of your hosts, Matthew Dawkins, and I am joined today by Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And Eddie Webb.
Nope.
But wait.
Yeah, remember last time when I wasn't here?
Yeah, that's not Eddie Webb. That's not him at all. And if I rip the mask off of him, who is it? It's Richard Dansky. It was Richard all along.
I'm shocked. Shocked, I tell you.
I would have gotten away with it if it hadn't been for you nosy kids and your darn dog.
Yeah, it was the dog that found you out, because you're more of a cat person, aren't you?
Mostly, yes.
Yeah, I see. We could pick up on these things. How long have you been posing as Eddie, Rich?
Quite some time.
Yeah, we couldn't tell. We couldn't tell.
You did a great impression.
Thank you. I've been working on it.
As it may become apparent to the listeners, Eddie isn't with us for this episode. We are not just interviewing Richard Dansky for this episode, we also have him for the intro and the outro, so there's something a bit special for you. And as ever, we usually open this thing with a vague ramble about role-playing as it is today. So here's a role-playing thing today, Dixie, mm-hmm. and Rich.
Yeah.
I got my deluxe copy of Wraith the Oblivion 20th Anniversary Edition today.
Yay! That's so exciting. I did not back Wraith 20th Anniversary Edition because I'm the worst person ever. But I have touched a copy of the deluxe in the past week, so that's cool. But yeah, it's a gorgeous book. I'm really really happy it's finally out and getting shipped to people.
And Rich, I know you've touched a few copies yourself.
Yes, I had the stack of 10 boxes shipped to me so I could autograph the backer copies for that, and was mildly concerned about that much concentrated Wraith curse in one place.
Oh no, yeah, you probably should store them in separate locations.
But I'm sure then it would make some kind of evil pentagram that would that would swaddle the United States of America. But then again, how much worse can North America get right now? Oh, sorry, yeah.
Let's not ask that question.
We've done this once before, haven't we? And it's always the Europeans who seem to be insulting America on this podcast.
Yeah, well, gaming podcast, fine.
something, Brexit something.
Oh, hell. Yes. Yes, well, moving swiftly on.
The Onyx Path World Politics Corner.
Yes, obviously I'm very, very proud of my nation's politics as they are today. Rich, so obviously having now had a chance to handle, fondle, caress, reject angrily afterwards your deluxe copies of Wraith 20, how do you feel to now know that they are being received by the backers who have long awaited them?
It feels fantastic, and the reaction that I've seen from people who've gotten their copies has been very, very heartwarming. I mean, it is such a beautiful book. It is such a culmination of so many people's efforts, and it's the fusion of the art and the writing into one combined artifact is just sensational. So I'm extraordinarily proud of it, and I'm very glad it's in people's hands.
Yeah, there's always something really just satisfying about seeing the final book, since so many people see so many bits and pieces of books as they go on. Like, and since I edited Wraith, like, I, you know, read all the text and so forth and so on, but I hadn't seen any of the art until I saw the deluxe, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Very pleased with it.
It's one of those things that surprised me, I have to be honest. I mean, we got Cobb and a lot of the other classic artists back on Wraith 20, but one of the things I never really envisioned for Wraith 20 was colour art, because I've always loved Wraith the Oblivion, and I was fortunate enough to be hired by Mr. Dansky to work on this book. It was my very first core rulebook. And despite everything that we went through producing this book, I never pictured it with color art. And now that I've got a chance to see it, it's enough to change perception. And that's something that's very strange for me to say, because I'm someone, I will put my hands up and admit it, I've very rarely looked at role-playing game art in a lens that makes me say, wow. And Wraith 20 hits that bar for me that games like Planescape do, which kind of takes it to a different level. And it really appeals to my sensibility. And that was just something that was really surprising to me, to see the effective way color can be used in a game like Wraith, which always seemed to me so black and white.
Mm-hmm. What was the Art Notes art process like on that, actually, since we have people that can give us insight here?
Long and arduous. But the world of Wraith has never been without color. It's just always been muted and sort of there for heightened effect when it is there. And so the choice to go with color art, that was made on the art side, not by me. That was just a fantastic decision. Writing the art notes was... part of it was just getting used to the new format, because I'm old and cranky and was used to the old way of doing art notes. But being able to really get in there with the nitty-gritty of each chapter and talk about what the sense of the chapter was, rather than saying, okay, I specifically want a picture of a guy with a hat, I think that went a long way towards giving the artist freedom to do what they wanted to do and really come back with some sensational stuff that expanded the world of Wraith.
Right.
Obviously, we had a lot of back and forth on this one, Rich, with drafts, when we got it to development, and of course proofing and errata, and being such a large book. I mean, would you? And this is a gap in my knowledge. Would you say you've ever worked on a book as dense with information as this one before?
Absolutely not. This was the monster to end all monsters for me. It was somewhere, I won't say it's twice the size of Wraith Second, but it's getting up there in terms of word count. And it's just, there was so much that I wanted to put into it, and even so much that got left out. Just because of space considerations. And I figured this was my one bite at the apple, so I didn't know what the future of Wraith would be, so I wanted to give as much as possible to the fans so they could have it all there in one book.
Right. It definitely has. It's strange seeing the iteration of all the 20th anniversary editions. Or rather the advancement, where we look at Vampire 20 as very much isn't copied and pasted text, as a lot of people seem to say, but it is very much a rehash of old information. I know that's not very complimentary, but that is what it is. Whereas Werewolf 20 makes some gentle steps forward to actually say, okay, but this is what werewolves might look like now, and let's shave off some of the edges that made Werewolf problematic. And then Mage, of course, goes whole hog on changing things, despite the fact, you know, it's still 20th anniversary edition. Changeling 20 does a similar thing. Then we have Wraith, and maybe, I don't know, you never got a chance to do a revised edition for Wraith, so I guess, Rich, you've had to incorporate two editions worth of changes into one book.
Yeah, that was very much the case.
Yeah, speaking critically, I guess, how successful would you say you feel you've been at doing so? And, do you think it translates? Does it feel like a modern game and the most up-to-date version of Wraith you'd like to see?
I think it does. I mean, the ultimate verdict comes from the fans and their reaction to it. But I'm pleased with the book as a whole. There's always places where you realize you missed stuff, or you realize you made a mistake. And believe me, I've been beating myself up over those for years now. But on the whole, I think it is very much a modern look at Wraith. Wraith, in its own way, is sort of timeless.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it very much is all of history combined into one setting. So the advance of a few years, even with the incredible changes in technology we've seen, aren't that much to the empire that is Wraith, aren't that much to the overall world. And so I had the advantage of not having to worry quite as much over what cell phone technology could do in a Wraith setting as opposed to, say, Vampire. And so I could focus more on going in depth rather than pushing the timeline forward.
We discussed Wraith not long ago on this podcast. We did a bit of a deep dive of our own because we all came at Wraith with different levels, I guess, of expertise. And something we all agreed on is at times in the previous editions, there's been a perceived lack of accessibility when it comes to Wraith the Oblivion. And perhaps it's because it's based mainly in the Shadowlands, whereas the rest of the World of Darkness games are based mainly in the Skinlands. So I guess I'm a bit of an on-the-spot question, but what would be your proposed scenario, just a brief, for a new group that was looking to run Wraith the Oblivion for the first time?
One of the classic examples that I've heard is people sit down to play another game, all their characters get killed, and then are remade as Wraiths. So they have characters they're already comfortable with to a certain extent, and then they can just simply move forward into the scenario where they're now Wraiths. And I always thought that was an ingenious sort of solution.
Well, and to build on that, what would be your... I know I'm asking for a million ideas a minute, but let's say you wanted to introduce someone to the politics of Stygia, the hierarchy, and the guilds, and the like. What would your introduction to those concepts be? Because I'll just clarify this a little. I would say that because of the... rather built-in politics of Wraith the Oblivion. Again, some people can see it as a barrier to entry. And indeed, some people can look at the meta plot of Vampire the Masquerade and feel the same thing. So let's say someone really wants to get down and dirty with the Shadowlands and the politics there. How would you recommend introducing those rather heavy weights?
I think it was Tip O'Neill who said that all politics is local. So I would start with, at the beginning of the game, laying out the politics of the local necropolis, showing where the factions were, showing who was in allegiance to whom, and implying heavily that there were further paths to follow from there. But just getting people started with the local aspects of Stygia, the local tentacles of the beast, as it were, would go a long way towards, I think, piquing interest towards the greater story that's being told.
And other than, well, obviously we know you've been invested in Wraith the Oblivion deeply, for what would I guess that would be the majority of your tabletop role-playing game career. But you were, of course, heavily invested in Vampire the Dark Ages as well, weren't you?
Yes, I was developer on that for a while.
And so here's a question, because for anyone listening who doesn't know, I think Rich and I first spoke on my YouTube channel many years ago, and it was only subsequent to that I got into writing, and then I got back in touch with Rich and asked him about getting involved in Wraith, and I don't think I've ever discussed Vampire with him, but what would you... Well, so I'm assuming... In fact, I won't assume. What is your favorite era to actually play Vampire in or run Vampire in? Would it be the Dark Ages?
Yeah, it really is. There's something about letting monsters be monsters that just really appeals to me. And playing around with the historicity and the naked feudalism as opposed to the sort of hidden feudalism of the Camarilla was something that really appealed to me. So getting it out, not in the open per se, but a more straightforward vampire, I guess, is the best way to put it. And having an opportunity to play a little more with faith as an aspect of the setting was something that I wanted to do. So you had books like The Cainite Heresy come out of that.
Those vampire faiths are actually seeing a bit of a resurgence now in the 5th edition of the game. It's been a strange thing in Vampire the Masquerade how that ecclesiastical horror has never really been its focus, at least not in the modern age. You've had the Sabbat side of things, where they take the trappings of Catholicism. But now, with the 5th edition, the Church of Cain, of course, because the Cainite heresy don't call themselves a heresy, but as a general rule, is kind of ascendant. The Bahari, with the cults of Lilith, are all popping up again. So a lot of those concepts that you helped form way back in your work on Dark Ages are making a resurgence. And I would hate for it to be, a bit of a facile question, but as a creator, someone who started working on these things in the mid-90s, how does it feel to know that your ideas are being built upon, occasionally respawned, I guess, with sometimes new ideas bolted on, sometimes it is the original idea just being presented in a slightly different format?
It feels great, honestly, just to see that the ideas have life, that they're still speaking to people, that there's something in there that people want to, you know, sink their hands into and play with. And that's honestly kind of an honor that something that was done so long ago still speaks to people. It makes me feel good to know that material is alive and well and still growing.
That's awesome. I mean, it's kind of funny because most of the stuff that I know of yours is mostly your novels and fiction from back in the day. Because that's all the stuff that I kind of remember seeing your name on. I think it's easier to remember who wrote something when it's, you know, the byline on the front cover than when it's on the interior credits. And my gaming group in high school and throughout never got into Wraith. We got into a few of the White Wolf games, but not every single one. So, I've still got copies of things like Clanbook, the Le Sombre novels, stuff like that. And I know some of the Exalted novels I think you worked on, too.
Yes, I did the Trilogy of the Second Age.
So do you prefer doing fiction when you're writing, or do you prefer writing more game mechanics and setting?
You know, it uses different muscles. Mm-hmm. And that goes for my day job as well, writing video games. There's certain things that you do and don't do for each type of writing that are enjoyable and pleasurable to do that you don't get to do in other stuff. So I do enjoy getting, you know, elbow deep in rules and writing rules for tabletop. But at the same time, you know, there's something very pleasant about writing fiction, just knowing where the characters are going to go and not having to be open-ended with everything. I can actually draw a conclusion.
Yeah, I think I feel the same way about editing fiction versus editing, you know, actual RPG books, because as much as I enjoy editing core books and I enjoy editing supplements, it's kind of nice to be able to follow a plot while I'm editing and not just getting like information dumped into my brain the whole time. So those they're easier and they're a lot quicker usually than trying to edit a core. The Wraith core specifically was, I think, the largest book I've ever edited. It's like 330,000 words, I think, if I remember correctly.
That was the number, yeah. And thank you for doing such a great job with it, by the way.
Oh, thanks. I had a lot of fun with that one. I joke about it that it's my proudest editing moment at Onyx Path to have decapitalized the word guild. Because it was used too much. But yeah, like, I had so many of your books back when I was like really devouring all of the fiction for various White Wolf things. And I mean, you've worked on just about every original White Wolf line on some level, haven't you?
I didn't do anything with Street Fighter, but other than that, pretty much, yeah.
I'm sure that's your biggest regret in the tabletop RPG field. Okay, well, now here's an on-the-spot question. What would you have done with Street Fighter the RPG, Rich Dansky?
Well, Street Fighter the RPG was such a perfect expression of what it was that the only the only place to go from what was already there was further over the top. And so, you know, just kick out all the jams, throw all caution to the winds, and go crazy with new characters would have been the only place to go with that, because it already was so perfectly encapsulated itself.
It's odd to look back at that, isn't it? It's a different time, because my understanding, and I'm trying to remember the people I've spoken to about the Street Fighter RPG, has been a few who worked on it. And the only guidance from Capcom of the time was just don't kill any of the characters from the video game. Otherwise, you know, go mad. Do what you like. And to think now, you wouldn't get that kind of freedom, that kind of free reign with it.
God, no.
Major video game license. But actually, and there's a hypothetical for you. Obviously, you know your games. You work in the gaming industry, video gaming. Yeah, and it's the hypothetical question that's often thrown out there. If you could take a video game license and you had free reign to turn it into a tabletop RPG, doesn't have to be for a company you work for, what game would you go for, and why would that make a good RPG?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. Because there's so much of the tabletop industry that's fed into video games. So many of the conventions have been sort of adopted upwards that, you know, even as you're playing video games, on a certain extent, you're still playing the old RPG mechanics. But if I had to pick one, I would say The Witcher 3, simply just from the breadth of its world.
Well, our Talsorian are going to be very happy, because they recently released a Witcher tabletop RPG. It's got, I think, got more links to the novels than the video game, but I have no doubt. Well, I don't know how many books they're intending on releasing for it, but I've no doubt they're going to be pulling some elements from the games.
Well, that's very cool.
Yeah, well, they're still around, still kicking. It's all these companies that were, I guess, big in the 90s, making their way, and they're still around now. But, and of course, back when you were involved with White Wolf of the 90s, it was a very different beast to any of the companies, I guess, that existed then or exist now. Mm-hmm. And while a lot of us have heard a lot of the stories from the office there of the general mania and chaos that went into production.
No, it was an incredibly sober place. We were all just very dedicated to the work, and I'm sorry, I can't finish that with a straight face.
Yeah, I've been to a couple of parties at the old office. Like, no.
Okay, true story. I was at GDC years ago at one of the White Wolf parties, and someone who'd been in my writer's roundtable came up to me at the party and said, "Isn't this the best party ever?" And I said, "Yeah, it's a pretty good party." And he says, "No, man, you have to imagine yourself 10 years ago when at this party." And I said, "10 years ago, I was at this party."
But okay, so we know White Wolf is an incredibly chaotic place. But are there any practices that you took from your work there that you still apply in your work now?
Oh, absolutely. Rob Hatch once said that White Wolf was a place where talented people went to learn their craft, and there's a certain truth to that. Part of it just in terms of dealing with other people and dealing with other people's writing. I learned how to edit. I learned how to give critique. I learned how to improve other people's writing through my time at White Wolf. And those techniques have been incredibly valuable to me working on writing teams. And organization is another skill that I took from the time at White Wolf. I mean, our schedules back in the day were crazy. They were overstuffed, I guess is the best word for it. And being able to do time management on projects and not just rely on ye olde brinksmanship was a skill that was hard learned and carefully hoarded since then.
I mean, that's something that I think in our current, you know, way that we work, where almost everybody is a freelancer and we're all remote, I think that's actually one of the harder skills to pick up if you don't already have it from having like an office job. It's something that I very much have been talking to Matthew and Eddie and some of my other friends who work from home about, because like this, I've never had an office job before this, which our listeners may not know. I've always worked in retail or in food service, you know, things of that nature, where I, you know, you pretty much know what you have to do every day when you go in, and it's all based on what the clients need or a preset schedule or what have you. So working from home and going like, oh, I can make my own schedule, that's great, and then having the panic of, oh no, I can make my own schedule. This is terrible. Like, it's a struggle, and it really is a skill that, you know, you have to either teach yourself or be taught.
Oh yeah, well, project management, and that's a lot of what we do. Well, what it would be classed as now is a skill you can often only learn through repetition, through making mistakes, and through observing others. But it's interesting. Well, what both of you say, and Rich, you saying about how, you know, you learn to take critique, you learn how to edit, and when I first started doing this RPG writing lark that appears to have become my full-time career now, the first sets of red lines I got from developers were pretty comfortable, very hand-holdy, or non-existent. And different developers work in different ways, I accept that. But then I got to work for you. And I got my first, what I would consider my first decent set of red lines. And anyone who listens to this will be aware, red lines are the stage where developers go through a writer's first draft, and they make notes, they make critiques, hopefully constructive ones, generally they are, and it helps the writer deliver a final draft that is to spec, to put it simply. And Richard gave me incredibly thorough red lines that they left a mark, I should say. I was never traumatized by them.
This is good.
But they were the best learning experience I've ever had in this industry. And I'm not just saying that because you're here. I think I may have mentioned it on a separate podcast that it was, and I mentioned it at Midwinter Gaming Convention this year as well. I was discussing with Rich Thomas different development styles, and I said that, you know, the developer that actually turned me into a half decent writer was Rich Dansky, because he actually took the time to go through my work and not just correct what was wrong and not just excoriate me for mistakes that I'd made, but actually to give me advice in the margins and in emails. You know, you did the job. And I owe you a massive debt of thanks that, you know, I'm dropping on you right now, because, yeah, you were exactly what I needed at that point in my development as a writer.
Well, thank you. It's very kind of you to say that. And the motto that I always had as a developer was not how would I write this, but how can the author write this better? And too many of the red lines that I received were how the developer would have written it themselves. And I never felt that was the way to go. I mean, if I wanted to write it myself, then I would just have hired myself. And that's the way that, you know, that would have been the end of it. You know, I hired you because I wanted to see what you had to say. And I wanted you to say what you had to say to the best of your ability. And so I could see where you were going from your first draft and try and hone the direction that you were going in while taking off some of the spiky bits that would have been off-putting to the book's audience. You do realize that I did all of your red lines sitting in the airport in Charlotte, North Carolina, by the way.
So you were in the best possible mood to do them.
Yeah, they were good. You gave me good material, and you took feedback well, which I very much appreciated. And it was material that I could sink my teeth into, and the changes that you needed to make were clear, so I could explicate them in a way that was obvious and clear to you.
Well, and I specifically very rarely use adverbs now in my work.
That's good. Adverbs are of the devil.
it was definitely you that you taught me the perils of leaning on adverbs, I think, is is the way I certainly put it to my writers now. And it's strange because now, of course, I develop books, and an awful lot of the advice I give to writers is advice that I learned from taking it from you. So yeah, that's it's been an interesting few years. And through all of this, of course, Wraith 20 has been in production, and perhaps it's worth explaining to the listeners, because a lot of people, of course, backed Wraith 20, and several of them, and many of them, got frustrated, got upset that Wraith took quite a while to see release. And we, Onyx Path, we hold our hands up and say there were several delays, but it was also a massive book. And we often attribute such delays to the Wraith Curse. And Rich, maybe you could explain how the Wraith Curse manifested, a few of the instances of its manifestation during the course of this book's production.
And here I was thinking that this was like the sweetest and gentlest little interview we've had so far, because y'all are just being so nice to each other and are going to talk about the Wraith Curse again.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the doom of Wraith 20.
Okay.
The doom that came to Durham. You know, when I first got the gig to write, to develop Wraith 20, I was ecstatic. My ex-wife said it was the happiest she'd ever seen me. And I was very, very excited and very optimistic, and set wildly optimistic deadlines going in. And then things started to happen. Part of it was writers having difficulty of all sorts. Some of it was financial difficulties. Some of it was physical difficulties. Some of it was seriously health-related stuff. And in my personal life, things sort of completely fell apart. I joke with people that when this project started, I had two parents and a marriage and three cats. And now I've got no parents, no cats, no marriage. So it did take a toll. And I'm not blaming the Wraith or the Wraith Curse for everything. But it did seem to hover around and take its swipes whenever it wanted to. And it was everything from, you know, big things like that to smaller things like files refusing to translate, files disappearing out of folders, formatting unraveling itself, formatting refusing to take. And a lot of people who started laughing at the Wraith Curse by the time they got through their time working on the book were not laughing any longer.
Yeah, I am a super non-believer in supernatural stuff, like, at all, really. And even then, it's like, oh, the first time that we ever mentioned Wraith in the podcast, the episode disappeared. Like, that was weird. We kind of decided when we went to the deep dive that if anything happened, we were just going to abandon the topic entirely. Like, we'll talk about something else.
The curse is alive and well and waiting for its next chance to take vengeance, I'm sure.
Sounds like it.
Dude. Rich, do you mind, and if you do, I can quite easily edit this bit out. Do you mind if I ask a bit of a personal question? If the question is completely off base, tell me, and we'll cut this. So, I've been your friend on Facebook for a while, and I know that you had a very close relationship with your father. I've got a very close relationship with mine. And I would often see and like the side-eye photos of your dad at the baseball. And I was wondering, as someone who seems to have had a very close relationship with his dad, what impact, what influence your father has had on your creative life. Because, I don't know, I get a feeling there's a story there.
Yeah, Dad very much encouraged me. Dad was a huge science fiction and fantasy fan, and he loved that I was doing these games and that I was writing fiction, and so he always very actively encouraged it. I mean, my first deep dive into science fiction and fantasy was when I found his collection in the basement of our house in Philadelphia and started chewing through books that I was probably not ready to chew through. I mean, you're not really ready for Samuel R. Delaney at age 14. You're just not.
No, I'd say probably not.
But he was a huge fan of what I did, and you know, every time I had something come out, he wanted a copy of it. He wanted to read it. He never quite got into role playing. That was a little much for him, but he could appreciate the writing in the books, and he was always very much involved in my fiction when it came out, and always wanted a copy of that. And his car was filled with anthologies that I had a story in. Just they were reading material for him while he was waiting for my niece and nephew to pick them up from school or things like that.
Oh, that's wonderful, wonderful to hear. And of course, we've touched on this briefly, but you of course now work in video games primarily for Red Storm, which is a subsidiary of Ubisoft, unless I'm very much mistaken.
You are correct.
I think that his actual title is Central Clancy Raider, from what I saw in the biography, which is a really fun title.
And well, you were I assume that was your title on the creation of The Division.
I was the lead writer on the original Division. Something that people a lot of times don't understand is that any individual working on a video game is a very small cog in a very big machine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pleased and honored to be a part of The Division and to have contributed to it. Mm-hmm. There were people at, I think, four or five studios worked on that game and all came together to make something great. And so just having contributed my small part to it felt good as part of that collaborative effort.
It's I'll be honest, I don't often play first-person shooters. I nearly called them shoot-em-ups. How old am I?
You're younger than me, Matthew.
don't often play these shoot-em-up games in the arcade, but but I did play The Division, and I did enjoy it a great deal. So I do hope you and the rest of the teams are proud of your work on that. I know, obviously, it has been very well received over the length of time since its release. So, well, yeah, again, must be gratifying.
It really is, and there is, you know, what I tell people is my job is to help people have fun. And I think there's a great deal of truth to that. I mean, I am helping make a game, helping craft something for people's enjoyment. And when you see people actively enjoying the work that you've done, that's just a fantastic feeling.
How did you make the migration from tabletop RPG to video game industry?
I was at White Wolf, and I was sort of struggling a little bit with what to say next. I had done Charnel Houses, I had done Wraith Second, I had worked on the Guide to the Camarilla, and I was sort of a little bit creatively adrift. And a friend of mine who worked at Red Storm started nudging me to apply up here because they were doing a story-driven game, and they needed a designer who could also write. And he was, shall we say, very persistent until the point where I finally sent in a resume so I could tell him that I'd done it and he could stop bothering me. And the next thing I knew, they were flying me up for an interview. And I went home. I got a phone call saying, don't go anywhere over the weekend. We're going to make you an offer on Monday, which was mind-blowing to me. I called Ken Cliff, who was my manager at the time. I said, Ken, I've just gotten an offer from a video game studio. And he said, take it.
That's about the best possible way that could have worked out. I think it's always a good sign when a studio is willing to fly you somewhere for an interview.
It was a really interesting experience because my video game habits at that point consisted of largely playing Civil War Generals 2 over and over again, trying to come up with the perfect solution to the Battle of Gettysburg. And so I was not a typical gamer by any sense, stretch of the imagination, but luckily they took a chance on me and hopefully people have been pleased with my work over the last 19 years, at least enough to keep me around.
Well, hopefully that doesn't mean you're completely done with the tabletop industry. If we can ever hire you for a small freelance project, you know where we are.
Well, thank you very much. Right now I'm in the rest and recuperation from Wraith phase.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, understandably that may take a while.
Yeah, but, you know, tabletop RPGs are my first love, and, you know, it's always an honor to be a part of a project.
Do you ever get much of a chance these days to play tabletop games, whether board games or RPGs?
I do a weekly game night with friends, but we do board games more than we do role-playing games. My travel schedule for work over the years has been so erratic that it's always been impossible to set up some sort of regular RPG session. You know, last year I spent 4 months on the road, and that just sort of eats into a group scheduling ability.
What board games are currently on offer in your gaming group?
Let's see. Last week we played Euphoria, Azure is a big one.
Yeah, I've got that right next to me, actually.
Keep an eye on it. It's a sneaky one.
No, sorry to continue.
It's okay. It's just whatever people feel like playing any given week, and I show up and lose spectacularly.
Yeah, I've never had much luck with board games, but and yet we still persist, because are we not gamers?
Yep. I have a linen closet that is filled with games. Don't ask me where I keep my linens.
So out of interest, in the tabletop industry, is there something you ever wanted to do that you never got the opportunity to? Because as you say, you were feeling slightly adrift when you came to the end of your tenure, your full-time tenure at White Wolf. But I assume since that time you've occasionally had the pangs of creativity where you wanted to go and either create something new or revisit an old friend. And as we know, that's what you've done with Wraith the Oblivion. But is there a game on the market or one that you would, an idea that might spawn into something greater?
I always wanted to play around with something in the Civil War time period. I thought that was particularly fertile. I mean, Deadlands took that and went a few years further forward, but that was always sort of the historical period that I wanted to sink my teeth into and maybe make a game out of. I never quite got around to it. There was a kids' RPG that I was working on at one point, but that sort of crumbled under the onslaught of the grimly relentless adult material of Wraith and Dark Ages.
Yeah, it can be quite difficult to switch those gears, can't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even switching between, like, World of Darkness stuff and, you know, Pugmire is difficult sometimes, so...
Pugmire is something... awesome, by the way.
Oh, Eddie will be very pleased to hear you've said that. But yeah, it's something we've commented on this podcast before. It's something we sometimes feel we need. Eddie, Dixie, and myself, obviously Eddie, have all worked on Pugmire or Monarchies of Mao in
Eddie
some
worked on
form
Pugmire?
Or other. Yeah, a little. You know, he just put an idea on a piece of paper and then said to the writers, go with it, just do what you like. And... But having it there as a palate cleanser is and a breath of fresh air, especially when you are so neck deep in World of Darkness or Chronicles of Darkness for years and years, is it's nice to have that island, I guess, in the Tempest to take us back to Wraith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what Changeling was back in the World of Darkness days.
Mm-hmm.
So I could, you know, do a little writing in something that wasn't quite as relentlessly epic and to use a little bit of a lighter touch. And so, of course, you know, I did the dark, grim parts of Changeling with Slua and Red Caps, but even so, it was a little bit of a change up from Wraith and from Dark Ages and let me play a little bit with the lighter side of things.
I mean, for what it's worth, the Slua are my favorite, so... Like, I did a Changeling LARP at Midwinter last year, and that's what I played. Excellent. I used to play back in the day too, so thanks.
I'm glad you enjoy them.
I know this story because it's something Rich and I have discussed before, but for anyone who doesn't, so one of the probably most important books of the 90s in RPGs was The Shoa, Charnel Houses of Europe for Wraith the Oblivion. It was released under the Black Dog imprint, but whatever way you cut it, it's a fantastic source book. It's a fantastic book in general, and as most people who are listening to this will know, it's the Wraith the Oblivion book that handles the very delicate subject of the Holocaust. Now, Rich, am I correct in thinking you pitched this book?
I did, and I got a lot of stunned faces when I did. But the point I made when I pitched this book was that we were making a lot of noise about being role-playing for adults and adult material, and if we wanted to do adult material, here's a chance to do it in a way that wasn't EC horror, that wasn't R-rated for the sake of gratuitous nudity and violence. There was a chance to really explore adult themes in role-playing. And, you know, to their credit, the management of White Wolf greenlit the book and let me charge full tilt with it.
And perhaps you could explain some of the process that went into the creation of that book and any controversy that it met following its release.
Well, the key thing to do during the book was make sure that the fictional material and the real-world material were kept separate so that there couldn't be an accusation that we were trivializing the actual events. And so the book was given to Rob Hatch and Jonathan Black, which is a pen name for a friend of mine who had studied World War II history in college. And they did a superb job, in my opinion, of keeping the lines very, very clear, showing the obvious results, showing the what the consequences could have been if the World of Darkness were real, of this horrible series of events, while absolutely not treading on the reality of what happened. And so that was the sort of the backbone of the book and the thing that I drew strength from when I was working on it, that this was not only going to be a useful role-playing supplement that was going to really, I think, explore adult themes and explore adult questions, but it was something that hopefully people could learn a little bit from. And naturally, as soon as it was announced, the internet went bananas. And we were accused of all sorts of things. To be fair, White Wolf had not had a great track record with historicity at that point. And so there was, outrage over the possibility that we would get research wrong. There was outrage over the possibility that we were trivializing the show into making it a game. And what I tried to do was engage with the people who were most earnestly and loudly protesting. I would get in touch with them. I would send them parts of the manuscript. I would offer to talk with them. And once we were able to sit down and have face-to-face conversations, or not face-to-face, but email conversations or phone conversations, a lot of the fears were allayed when people saw what I was trying to do and was trying to make a positive good with the book. And then there was the infamous Harlan Ellison phone call. Yes, this was back when Harlan was one of White Wolf's writers. But Janet Berliner, who wrote the intro to the book, was a friend of Harlan's, and she was witnessing the struggles I was having with people ranting and raving about it. And she said, "Why don't you write to Harlan?" He had the same thing come up with the "I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream" video game. Mm-hmm. And so I took a week and wrote a letter to Harlan Ellison, because Harlan Ellison, and I put a copy of the manuscript in with the letter and sent it off, and I waited a week, and I waited another week, and I waited another week, you know, I didn't hear anything. Figured, you know, he's a busy man. He's got no time for something like this. And then my phone rang, and I pick it up, and I say hello, and I hear, Dansky, this is Ellison. And he proceeded to give me the most profane rant of support that I've ever received in my life. I mean, this is, the phone melted just from the sheer force and volume of his outspoken support for what I was doing. And at the end of 10 minutes, he finally said, you got that? I said, yes, sir. He said, good. Hung up.
Did you ever speak to Harlan Ellison again after that point?
I ran into him at World Horror Con in New York City, and we spoke for a little bit. He was gracious enough to admit that he did not remember the conversation in question, but was pleased that he had been able to provide some support and that he had been a help in getting the project off the ground.
That's one thing that I always enjoy when we look back, because, you know, because every now and then somebody on online or at a convention or whatever will talk about past missteps or that, you know, a company hasn't always been perfect about things, and there are inevitably a couple of White Wolf titles to get brought up. But the minute someone tries to bring up Charnel Houses as a, you know, example of how White Wolf did a terrible thing, there's always like 10, 15, 20 people stepping in going, no, that one's amazing. Like, we can't, that's not the bad one. That's never been the bad one. That one was incredibly well-researched. It was incredibly sensitive. People hold it up, you know, alongside more modern titles like, you know, Harlem Bound and stuff like that, as just being like a super well-researched look at a horrifying thing that happened in the real world. So I think that's really awesome that it still holds up to that, you know?
Thank you. Yeah. It amazes me that people are still pointing to it, but at the same time, you know, it makes me feel proud that the work was good enough to stand up through all these years.
Yeah, I was, I wasn't actually really role-playing when it came out. I'm sorry, I'm young. But I didn't know about it. I was definitely probably far too young for it. So it wasn't until the past few years that I actually learned about the book's existence at all, and it was because of that exact context, because someone said, like, you know, they did this, that, and other misstep, and this, that, and the other book, and somebody tried to bring it up, and they were like, no, that one's great, and I ended up going down an internet rabbit hole of researching the Shoah, which was fascinating.
I guess my emotional story related to it is, in my family, how best to put this? So we had French Jews in my family, and had being the correct tense, because they got caught up in the Holocaust and murdered. And so when I first read Charnel Houses of Europe, I'm feeling emotional right now talking about it. It's very strange. But I distinctly remember welling up. There's obviously something incredibly personal when your own family has been touched by that kind of experience, to put it mildly. And I remember distinctly when I got to the Baba Yar chapter about the Holocaust in Ukraine. And at that point, I just couldn't carry on reading. I had to put it down. I had to take a breath. And when I consider how young I was at that point, and it's taken me quite a long time in my life to really reach that level of maturity with horror, where it can start affecting me emotionally and where I can start empathizing with let's say, horror on the screen, it was a visceral enough gut punch to read a role-playing game source book that it's, you know, it just made me put it down. It made me have to step outside for a while, clear my head. And for me, you know, I shouldn't say role-playing book with such astoundment, but I think it was because I'd never read an RPG that had had such an effect. Everything before then had just been stats wrapped in flavor text. And now I was reading something that was genuine and heartfelt, and as you say, Dix, it was researched, and you could tell. So again, all credit to you and the authors on that book, and White Wolf of the 90s, Rich, because it's a it's a glorious piece of work.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad that, you know, it meant something to you. That's the highest tribute that could possibly be paid to the work.
Okay, so I've got a question for you, Rich, and this is just going to be a general one. If you've got an anecdote that you can give us about working on Wraith the Oblivion, about one of your experiences of working on it, from jumping on to developing second edition maybe, and what kind of experience that was for you, you know, especially compare it to how it came to develop 20th anniversary edition.
Oh boy. I'm trying to think of anecdotes that are clean, and I'm not coming up with
too many. They don't need to be clean.
As long as they're not incriminating. And if they are, you can change the names.
Okay, well, there's a guy whose name rhymes with Ditch Snamis. No. No, let's not go to that one. When I first moved down to Atlanta to work on Wraith, I was in the middle of doing my second round of rewrites on Guildbook Artificers, and so I was already entrenched into my habit of staying at the office all night. And this was one of my very first nights doing it, and I hear some thumping noises, and I go up front, and it is several of the senior members of the staff who have come back after an evening out, blind drunk and staggering, and they're back at the office for God knows what reason, and I think to myself, okay, what exactly have I gotten myself into? Well, there was a certain White Wolf attitude, which there was a question as to whether I was attitudinous enough for White Wolf at one point, because I was not as much of an imbiber as some of the other folks, but
right.
I've since made up for that with my love of scotch, so.
I also love scotch. That is definitely a fact people know about me.
Okay. Well, if you ever come back to North Carolina, you are more than welcome to sample the bar I've got set up.
Hey, that's actually always a funny connection to me, because you and Justin Achille both live in that area. And I grew up in Cary, North Carolina. And I didn't know there was a video game industry there when I was younger. And now I have a few people that I know who work for, you know, various video game and other nerdy companies in the area. And I'm always like, huh, I might have stayed if I had known those were options at the time. But instead, I moved to Atlanta, where I hung out with White Wolf people. And then eventually to Delaware. But yeah.
Yeah, no, there's quite the nerd hub here between us and Epic and Insomniac and some of the smaller studios. There's a ton of video game development.
Yeah, the only company that I had friends that worked for back in the early 2000s when I was still living there was Funcom.
Mm-hmm. They're still here.
Yeah.
And ex-White Wolfer Brian Glass works for Funcom now.
So weird how all these things intersect. It really is. Yep. We are not friends on Facebook because I have never met you until this podcast. But you know how it shows the people you may know based on other friends you have? I think mm-hmm. one of your Facebook friends who lives in that area is someone I used to play role-playing games with in high school. I'm not going to name people's names on the podcast, but that's just so weird to me how these things all kind of, like I said, are strangely connected.
It's a small world, and common interests tend to bind people together closely, and it's interesting seeing what you know, good people who are connected to good people, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
A positive message to end on. But no, it's exactly like you said at the beginning, Rich. You know, this RPG industry feeds into the video game industry in a lot of ways, and with personnel as well. So thank you very much for your time on this interview, Rich. It's been much appreciated, very insightful.
It has been my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on.
Now, if anyone wants to find you, follow you, or otherwise, well, I don't know, what else might someone do? Let's stick to finding and following you on social media. Are you available?
He's the best Twitter handle.
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter at rdansky.
My Twitter handle is currently Safety Dansky. Yeah, it makes me laugh.
That's one thing I didn't get to ask you.
Oh?
One thing I didn't get to ask you. It's not about safety, Dansky. It's obviously you've... so, sorry, we're not going to edit this. Bugger it. you very often go by the epithet, the nickname, the dead guy. And one would assume that is attached to Wraith the Oblivion.
That is correct.
When did you first pick up that name?
It first came up when I was doing the AOL chats for White Wolf back in the day. So, you know, this tells you how long ago it was that AOL was a thing. But my AOL account was WW Banquo because I was the ghost, and yes, all very clever and Shakespearean. but I started looking for something a little more pithy, and I didn't have to explain every time, and Dead Guy just sort of came up, and so I very quickly became the Dead Guy.
Well, now we know, and people can find you on Twitter at Safety Dansky.
No, at Arnold, but yeah.
We'll get it right at some point. Dixie, where can people find you?
As always, you can find me on Twitter, the forums, various Discord channels, all kinds of things, as Dixie Cyanide.
And you can find me pretty much everywhere that there is social media as The Gentleman Gamer.
Except
on Twitter, where I'm clack, click, bang. We should really try and make some kind of uniform naming thing for me, shouldn't we? It's all edging towards The Gentleman Gamer now. I'm clack, clack, click, bang. And YouTube, Gentleman Gamer. Onyx Path Forum, Gentleman Gamer. Do tune in to the... I know you don't really tune in, but bear with me. Do subscribe to the Onyx Path YouTube channel. Click on the bell as well, because that will notify you when new videos get uploaded, and we upload a lot of content now. Doesn't mean you need to watch it all, but there may be something on there that interests you, because we cover a lot of games every single week. And with that said, many worlds, one path, guys.